And welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. Our special guest, known to everybody, author Scott Hahn, along with Brandon McGinley, wrote the book Catholics in Exile, Biblical Wisdom for the Journey Home. Emmaus Road Publishing, available naturally through the EWTN Religious Catalog. EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. And speaking of all things Catholic, we've got the one and only Scott Hahn.
Great to be with you, Doug.
Who's been a part of the EWTN family for almost 30 years, I'd say.
Over
30 years at this point in time. I remember watching at home when you were on with Mother Angelica, and then obviously coming to work here in the late 90s and getting to work with you on some of the projects you've done over the years in concert with EWTN.
Coming back, it's amazing how much everything has changed, and yet everything is still the same.
Right. You know, the fidelity. Hopefully that same spirit.
Very much so.
With that. And speaking of, we got Catholics in Exile, the Biblical Wisdom for the Journey Home. So you pick this up and you think, oh, we're in trouble, we're in exile, but you actually think it's in some ways a good thing.
Well, I do. You know, I wrote this book with Brandon McGinley right after we had both published a book together called It Is Right and Just, Why the Future of Civilization Depends on True Religion. And you and I had a conversation about
right,
that
exactly.
book.
Right, exactly.
And it gave people the hope that they needed to kind of pursue Catholic values in the culture, in the public square, perhaps, you know, and to see that this has always been a part of Catholic mm-hmm. tradition. But then all of these people kept reading it and saying, get real. We're not going to see it. Our grandkids aren't going to see it. And so Brandon and I went to work for a couple more years, and we focused on this because what we were finding was that so many Catholics are discouraged. They're angry, or they're sad and depressed, or they're just downright cynical about the state of the world, the state of the country, you know, the secular leaders. We feel leaderless, but also in the church, even as Catholics, in your own diocese, sometimes even in your own parish, you're just sort of lost and wondering why. And so what I wanted to do was something constructive. And so Brandon and I went to work and found something that would not only give you hope, but also practical tips on how to raise your family and how to continue to grow spiritually and attain holiness the long way.
Now, you make the point that being in exile does not make one homeless, that we have a home. We're just not there right now.
That's right. And that's a theme that bridges both books. You know, some people say, well, I can't read this because it's a sequel. Actually, it's sort of chicken or egg.
You said it can go either way, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And so it might even be easier to begin with Catholics in Exile because it describes where we really are. And the fact is, you know, as Paul points out to the Philippians in 3:20, you know, our polituma is in heaven. And he uses the technical legal term for citizenship or commonwealth. It doesn't mean that we're not residents of Ohio or America or Alabama. It means we have a kind of dual citizenship, but not purely equal. One is eternal, divine, and heavenly, and the other one is not only temporal and earthly, but it represents our sort of apostolic assignment.
Right. What do you think sometimes, many times, the Catholic Church's great gift is the balance? And you think, you say, this is not a negative rejection of the world around us so much as a reminder to put it in perspective that this world isn't our home, we must not get too comfortable, that sometimes we either get too ethereal or we get too material.
Right. You know, and the standard rant is, oh, so-and-so's so heavenly minded, they're of no earthly good.
Right.
Well, there's a wrong kind of pietism, you know. But at the same time, if we're properly minded in toward heaven, in a certain sense, nothing will liberate us to be more active on earth, not only as citizens, but as apostles. And in a certain sense, it actually creates not only more freedom, but a sort of fearlessness, because we know that ultimately here we have nothing to lose, because we're going to have to give it up anyway as we transition into heaven. So there we are. There
right. You see, our aim in this book, therefore, is to go on a pilgrimage. And you make the point out that it's not fast-paced as an experience. The journey itself is almost as important as an arrival at the destination. Do you think part of the problem we have a lot of times, 10 tips to help me get to the, we're looking for the quick blurb answers. We kind of want to take that in so I can move on. And you're really saying here that we've got to appreciate the journey. And that's
right.
Where we learn from.
Yeah, you know, we begin in the New Testament where people are more familiar, especially in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, to show that the patriarchs themselves, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, consider themselves pilgrims and in exile. But we also look at 1 Peter 1:1, James 1:1, where you have this pattern where Peter's writing his first encyclical to the exiles of the diaspora. Now, Jews would recognize that immediately. But Christians would need some kind of background, mm-hmm. and that's what the Old Testament provides. And so we go back to the Old Testament to show that the idea of pilgrimage, the idea of sojourning, the idea of exile, these are three different ways to basically flesh out the experience of the people of God for the majority of the centuries of what we would call salvation history.
You say a pilgrimage can at times seem circular, repetitive, but it's supposed to feel like that. Why?
Yeah, I mean, a pilgrimage reminds us that this is a marathon, it's not a sprint, but we have to get up every day and go through each hour of the day. And so what we need to recognize is that the pilgrimage of Israel, for example, out of Egypt to Mount Sinai and eventually into the Promised Land, you know, it's not just over and done in a day. It isn't even over and done in a generation. And so we have to think of the daily responsibilities, but we also need to tap into an eternal perspective. Mm-hmm. And so going out and then coming home with the reminder that even if we live in Jerusalem, we're not really home. Even if we formed Catholic civilization, you know, next decade, we still wouldn't be home. We have to have that reminder that we're pilgrims, not until we see the face of God the Father. And since we pray our Father who art in heaven, well, if he's our Father, we're his family. But if he's in heaven, it doesn't matter what my return address is.
What struck me in reading the book, too, with the idea of saying, because it was a period of time when we had something called Christendom.
Right.
But we still weren't home, were we?
That's the point.
Right.
I mean, one of the things that we do in both books, and especially in this one, mm-hmm. is to point out that there is nothing like religion to form civilizations. That historians will show you, even atheists, that religion has a unique capacity to form civilization, especially the Catholic faith. Mm-hmm. I mean, the civilization of love, you look at, you know, you could look at the 12th century with Innocent III, you could look at the 13th century with Aquinas and Bonaventure or anybody else. But the real point of the Catholic faith is to form saints mm-hmm. more than civilizations. Seek first the kingdom of heaven, and these things might be added to you in terms of the Catholic culture. But I mean, this hankering for preconciliar Catholic America, you know, whether it is Fulton Sheen, you know, or where you have actors playing priests because that was the way to advance your career or whatever.
Right.
You know, there really is an understandable response of nostalgia, but it just isn't productive. And so what we're trying to do is find practical steps that will not only get us through the day, but get us through the life and a baton to hand off to our kids right. and our grandkids.
But isn't that also used sometimes against people whose goal is, I'm not trying to recreate the 1950s, but I do want to capture and make sure we're holding on to the truths of the faith that at least at some point were so much more obvious back then.
That's right. I mean, I remember reading as a brand new Catholic, Father Walsh's thick book, The 13th Century, The Greatest of Centuries, and I was convinced, mm-hmm. even more than the 1950s. But at the same time, it isn't nostalgia, but you want to draw all of the wisdom, all of the insight, the sacred architecture, mm-hmm. the awareness that, you know, as Catholics in America, there are, you know nothings. There are anti-Catholics, and there always will be. You know, if the Catholic faith has this unique capacity, mm-hmm. not only to form civilizations, but to form saints, then it explains why it also has this unique capacity to form opposition, mm-hmm. adversaries. Because if it's really holiness that we're here right. for, dang, that's demanding, you know? Yeah. That's really hard. And so when people just give up on holiness, they're gonna implicate us because they're gonna feel implicated by our faith. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you think of Tom Holland's book, Dominion, the Catholic faith raises this awareness of our own divine vocation and human dignity. On the other hand, it also generates a persecution thing that is standard down through the ages of church history, and we ought to buckle up for it because, like I said, even if we got the 13th century or went back to the 1950s, we're still in exile. We're pilgrims, we're not home yet.
Well, you make the point here. Catholics in today's secular West are in a very similar position to the saints of the Old Covenant, for one, like Jerusalemites, who remained in the holy city following the Babylon captivity. We live among the ruins of a civilization based on the new covenant of Jesus Christ, in which we still believe, but which the world around us has forgotten. The bottom line is that the exile is a fundamental reality of a Christian in every age.
That's right. Okay. There are two or three big ideas in this book. Mm-hmm. You know, one of them is that the Eucharistic liturgy is the engine of salvation history. It's not only what will get us home, it will make us saints. And the trajectory for this goes all the way back to my book, The Lamb's Supper. There's another thing that I want to emphasize, and Brandon as well, and that is what we call the Jeremiah option. chapter 4.
That's one of your chapters, right?
Yeah, right. Because the idea of Jeremiah 24, when there are some left in Jerusalem, but the majority are, have been sent into captivity there in Babylon, the people in Jerusalem think of themselves as, you know, favored by God. And so in chapter 24, this vision of the two baskets of figs, the good ones and the rotten figs, the rulers are actually the rotten figs. The Anoim, the poor, the oppressed, those in exile are being purified right. through their own sorrow and penance and poverty. And if there's any hope for the salvation of the Jerusalem rulers, it's found right. in these good figs that are in exile. And so this sets into motion something that leads, I suppose, more to Jeremiah 29. Mm-hmm. That really becomes the centerpiece of the book for, well, chapter 4, and then for the next right. several chapters.
In the chapter of Violence of Envy, you talk about Americans especially should understand the idea of pilgrimage because in one sense it's really an American idea. And you mentioned the idea that chapter 11 of Letters of Hebrews has a sort of literary map for that pilgrimage. Explain.
Yeah, well, chapter 11 is also known as the Hall of Faith because it begins with Abel. And it goes through Enoch and reaches up to Noah and Shem and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then you're off to the races all the way into the exile by the time you get to the end of the chapter. And Hebrews 12, one of my favorites, begins in the opening verses, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. Mm-hmm. Well, who are those? The faithful we have just chronicled. So when Jesus ascends into heaven, it isn't a solo flight. You know, it's not simply an elevator. He's taking mm-hmm. captivity captive. He's repopulating heaven with all of the Old Testament saints. And they're not just spectators, they're witnesses. They're interceding for us powerfully. And so what you get a sense of, going all the way back to Cain and Abel, mm-hmm. the idea of envy is so rich, but also dangerous.
Right.
We confuse envy with jealousy. When, you know, jealousy can be good, but it's usually bad. Envy is only and always one of the seven deadly sins.
Well, it's totally destructive.
That's right. Jealousy wants what another has. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God because he wants us. Well, we're his. Mm-hmm. Whereas envy, Wisdom 2:24, it was the envy of the devil that caused death to enter the world. Envy resents what another person has. He doesn't seek to acquire it. It seeks to destroy it. And once destroyed, it rejoices at the loss of the good of the right. neighbor. It is almost the purest expression of malice and pride.
Now, in Away From Home, Chapter 3, G.K. Chesterton begins his brilliant work, Orthodoxy, with the story of the English yachtsman. I was wondering why you particularly decided to pick that out. And you say, keeping our eyes fixed on our true home isn't about going backward, as we were alluding to before. It's about moving forward in faith. I thought that was a great point you made.
Yeah. Well, in a certain sense, that yachtsman who comes back home not knowing that he has just rediscovered England, mm-hmm. in a certain sense, shows us that the way to heaven is really rooted and grounded in our own spiritual life, in our own family life, and in rediscovering the fact that Emmanuel means God is with us right now. And so if we take that to heart, we realize that we're not going to be any better off if we move to another city. We're not going to be any better off if we move to another time period, which we can't do anyway. Mm-hmm. And so what we recognize is that Abraham, our father in faith, becomes this paradigm of what it means to sojourn with total trust mm-hmm. and at the same time, deep joy. Mm-hmm.
Now, you talk about in the Jeremiah option, which you were alluding to before, the idea instability and uncertainty can make the promises of God not just all that more appealing to us, but also more apparent to us as well. Recognize the fact our exile, not just from heaven, but from Christendom, gives us the opportunity to reform our lives on the basic forms which a new world can be constructed.
Yeah. I mean, that would take another hour or two to fully unpack, but I think, you know, what we do, especially with the Jeremiah option, is to look at the unprecedented crisis of faith that was caused not only by the exile, but the destruction of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. What? And the demolition, the desecration of the Jerusalem temple. I mean, the only near equivalent for us as Catholics would be if we woke up tomorrow and found out that Rome was nuked, that the Vatican was destroyed, that all of these treasures, you know, mm-hmm. would our faith survive? Well, I suppose it would. It might even flourish if it's rooted and grounded properly.
Right.
But would it go through a crisis like no other?
Right.
And it's proper. And yet at the same time, it's purifying.
Chapter 5, The New Reality. You talk, therefore, the mission of the church in the age is to be audacious, courageous, and undaunted. Do you think we're living up to that now?
Not even close. Okay. I mean, that's why we wrote the book. That's why we emphasized the Jeremiah option. And that's why I think there's a sense in which the laity are called to respond to the graces of God's word and the sacraments, and not to point fingers, not to find blame. There's always going to be more than enough to go around. But the Jeremiah option, it becomes the bridge from chapter 4 to chapter 5. Because, okay, what does Jeremiah tell the exiles? First of all, build houses and live in them. Mm-hmm. Don't just rent apartments. Don't just, you know, resort to tents. Build houses and live in them. Second, plant gardens and enjoy the fruit. Get your hands dirty. Hard work is the instrument of our own sanctification. Third, take wives and have sons and daughters. Be family-centered. But not just for yourself, mm-hmm. then give your sons and daughters to marriage, and they'll have kids too. So you're thinking not only in terms of the household and not just the individual, but an intergenerational commitment. And then finally, he says, multiply there, do not decrease. Be fruitful and multiply. Where have we heard that? Mm-hmm. Well, that was true in Israel. That was true throughout the whole earth. And so the unthinkable idea that you ought to seek the welfare mm-hmm. of the city to which the Lord your God has driven you and pray for the shalom, the welfare of that city, it's like, say what? You've got to be kidding. But that's what they did. And we read about this not only in Jeremiah, but in Daniel. The opening chapters show that Daniel and his friends are all Jews carried into Babylonian captivity. But what they do in faithfulness is to set into motion mm-hmm. the ultimate conversion of Nebuchadnezzar, and not just once, but twice.
Right. So chapter 8 it was, on the move. So I'm assuming that we're all kind of more like toads than anything else apparently in here, in the fact that we kind of put things off till tomorrow. You say, we look around at the wreckage of our culture, the institutionalization of abortion, sexual immorality, historic and ongoing structural injustice, the idolization of money, identity and power, the despair and isolation in a society that can't even be bothered to reproduce itself, and we become overwhelmed.
Well, I mean, that's it. I mean, that describes my own personal struggle. We have depression in my family going back generations. We've actually had suicide, though I don't want to talk about it. But, you know, I'm not prone to suicide or suicidal thoughts. But I can get it, because when you look at the culture and the toxicity levels that are rising, it's easy to understand why it is people give up. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, why we've got to stay on the move, because there really is only one option. That is, it's going to be heaven or not.
Right.
You know, without holiness, you will not see God. So we've got to strive for holiness, for without it, you will not see God. You know, that passage in Hebrews 12 is so critical to our own psychological welfare.
Right. And finally, in a chapter of the long game, if the view to the horizon is troubling, it is only because God has allowed it to be and because he wants us to learn something from it. It wasn't long ago that the view didn't look so harsh, when it seemed possible that our civilization could grow closer to the Lord in our time. But now that has been exposed as a mirage, and which we should consider a great blessing.
Yeah, because it's reality therapy. It's a reality check. You know, in that chapter, we look at John Paul, who's my hero and Brandon's. But the man behind him, the spiritual father figure, is Cardinal Wyszynski.
Right.
One of my favorite sections in the book is this long game chapter, where we unpack how Cardinal Wyszynski is really the key to unlocking how you could produce, in the midst of the Nazis and the communists, someone like Karol Wojtyła, mm-hmm. somebody like St. John Paul II. And Wyszynski, in some ways, is more of the heroic father figure for Polish Catholics than even John Paul the Great.
Right. So that's Catholics in Exile, Biblical Wisdom for the Journey Home. Also, since you're so prolific, I wanted to mention a couple of, in our closing minutes here, another book called Breaking the Bread, a Biblical Devotional for Catholics. I always think, you know, when they used to hear devotionals, I thought of devotions, but I never thought of devotionals. It always sounded kind of Protestant to me.
Yeah, okay, perhaps it does. But, you know, Ken O'Gorick and I worked on this for like 10 years, mm-hmm. and what we've done over the years is take all of the Sunday readings to show how they're never accidental. You always have the new concealed in the old and the old revealed in the new. It doesn't require a master's degree, but just a little bit of preparation. You can get a maximum out of the Sunday readings in preparation for the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass.
Right. Some of the comments, I think, that were Ralph Martin said, good idea integrating the Sunday readings with excerpts from the Catechism. Also, breaking the bread is an ideal resource for families who want to incorporate the Mass and Scriptures mindfully into the practice of liturgical living at home. Are more people trying to do that? or need to do that? Because
yes,
because
not nearly enough.
We need to build ourselves up against the culture.
Right? Yeah, you know, when you asked the question, I had this conflicting thought that, on the one hand, yes, more than I ever expected, but no, not nearly enough, because you know, Dr. John Berg's my dear friend, our vice president at the St. Paul Center, has a four-volume work called Word of the Lord, which is really fodder for the priests and the deacons who are preparing the homilies to go deeper. This is more meat and potatoes, back to the basics for Joe Sixpack or any ordinary Catholic who just wants to prepare himself and his family for the Mass. And so, did not our hearts burn within us as he opened the Scriptures, but the eyes are open in the breaking of the bread. So breaking the bread is what kind of connects not just the old and the new, but the document we call sacred Scripture with the sacrament we call the Holy Eucharist.
You open the introduction with what a great rabbi, Samson Raphael Hirsch, said of his co-religionists, it's true of mine. The catechism of the Jew, he said, is the calendar. And you see the same for the Catholic Church with the calendar laid out, right?
You know, Raphael Samson Hirsch was the rabbi who's identified as the founding father of modern Orthodox Judaism. How are you going to do that given the diaspora, given the exile, as it were? And he said, look, we're not going to have a catechism anytime soon. We already have the liturgical calendar. Live it. Now, we have the liturgical calendar that we don't really appreciate. We've also got a lectionary that's been out for more than 50 years that increased the number of the Old Testament readings by 400%. And yet, no instruction was given to the seminarians or the instructors, the professors of the seminary, for the first 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And so what we're trying to do is equip the seminarians, the future priests, as well as ordinary lay people with the tools that they need to really see these connections.
Right. Now, this is cycle B, is that correct?
That's right, because that's what we're beginning
with. Right, exactly.
Advent
season. That's what we're in. Is there an A cycle and a C cycle coming out or already available?
So when we get to year C, that will be out next year.
Okay.
Or this year.
Right.
And then year A is also complete. And so we're just coming out with this because of a matter of time.
So then ultimately, once you have it, if you have all three, you really
exactly.
You really, the thing is,
it's hardback, it's sturdy. When you look at the beautiful sacred art inside, it's inspiring.
It's the kind of thing you can bring with you to Mass.
Yeah, it'll fit in your purse.
Right, exactly. My purse is a little smaller. But
it fits in the Kimberly's purse.
Breaking the, I'll tell my wife, Terry. Biblical devotional for Catholics. Okay, check that out. Also, just before we go, children's books now as well, huh?
Right.
The Supper of the Lamb. You and the Lamb got something going on here.
For many years.
So now you've got actually a rhyming book. Did you write the rhymes or was that Emily Stimson?
Oh, pure Emily Stimson Chapman.
Yeah.
Okay. Emily was one of my best graduate students ever. She was also an executive assistant. She is a gifted writer and poet. She helped me with a book on evangelizing Catholics. We have a friendship that goes back 25 years or so. You know, and the Lamb's Supper had such an impact in her life. We did Mary, Mother of All last year with Emmaus Road.
Right.
Then we talked about doing the Lamb's Supper, which was her longing. And so she did an amazing job in Mary. So I just had no doubt, no second thoughts. But the Supper of the Lamb takes the Lamb's Supper to the next level so that my own grandkids, and we've got 22 grandkids now, I mean, to read this to my grandkids is probably one of the thickest slices of heaven I've ever experienced.
Well, you said you dedicated to the children of all my former students to whom I'm blessed to teach the original version.
Right, because the Lamb's Supper came out in 99, but before it was a book, it was a series of lectures in at least three or four of my undergraduate courses. And all of these former students come back and introduce me to all of their kids, and I introduce them to the Supper of the Lamb so that you could teach the Lamb's Supper to your own little kiddos.
Right, and again, it's all done in rhyme, and
beautiful
wedding between
too.
God, yeah, exactly, God and man before the world fell, this was the plan, our God was true, but man was not, his word he broke, and promise for God.
You know, the thing I like the most about this book is how it gradually ramps up to recognize, to show kids that it's not just a supper, it's not just a meal, it really is a sacrifice. It's the holy sacrifice of the Mass, and it is the greatest sacrifice ever offered that we will celebrate until the end of time.
And the idea of going outside the church and trying to understand, well, how could what you're talking about be in the church? I've never seen these things in the church.
Right.
There's a mystery there.
Well, that's the heart of it. I mean,
right.
To translate sacred mysteries moves people from the visible to the invisible, you know, from the earthly to the heavenly, from the human to the divine. What do you call that? Catholic ed. Mm-hmm. And where does it start? As soon as the kids will pay attention to what it is you're reading. And the poetry, mm-hmm. it's so memorable. It's so memorizable, too.
Right. Another book in the works?
Yeah, three.
Okay. Well, we'll have to get you back here. The Supper of the Lamb, of course, and Breaking the Bread. You can check those out. But we really spent all of our time with Dr. Hahn on Catholics in Exile, Biblical Wisdom for the Journey Home. Highly recommend it. Check it out. And, of course, it's through our EWTN religious catalog, EWTNRC.com, for all things Catholic. I'm Doug Keck. We appreciate you stopping by. We'll see you next time right here on Bookmark.